Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. The Blood Drips by J.E. Muddock. For a long time, for years in fact, at short intervals, the following advertisement appeared in most, if not all, the London papers, and many of the provincial ones. To let, on long lease, at low rental, or freehold, to be sold cheap, a magnificent family residence, complete with every convenience, suitable for a large family. The house stands in its own grounds, comprising nearly 3.5 acres, part of which is natural wood, while the remainder is laid out as flower and kitchen gardens. There is stabling for 4 or 5 horses, with commodious carriage houses, harness room, hay, and corn lofts, and spacious apartments for coachmen, grooms, etc. The property, which is only 25 miles from London, enjoys an unequaled situation both as regards salubrity and views. The country is open all around with extensive woods in the neighborhood. The climate is bracing. Gravel soil lying on chalk, an adequate supply of water, and drainage perfect. Apply in the first instance to Smeaton, Weardale, and Smeaton, estate and house agents. Valuers and auctioneers, etc. 105 New Bond Street, London West. On the first blush, this advertisement was very attractive, and its bona fides was beyond question. Seeing that such a well-known and old-established firm as Smeaton, Weardale, and Smeaton was responsible for it, but a second reading would naturally have caused any thinking person to ask himself why. If this property was all that was represented, it should be offered at a very low rental or cheaply if bought. Now, it was very certain there was something wrong. Otherwise, a magnificent family residence and 3.5 acres of ground need not wait long for customer. But as already stated, this advertisement continued to appear at short intervals for years, so that those who were familiar with it knew quite well that out of the hundreds of thousands of people who must have read it, no one had yet been induced to invest. Now, what was the object in continuing the advertisement, upon which a large sum of money must have been spent, if a customer was not forthcoming? The only answer to this was that the owner or owners of the property hoped that by continuing it long enough, the advertisement would at least attract the right person, and in the end, this hope was realized. One morning, an August morning, it was brilliant with sunlight. When even grimy London looked bright and cheerful, a gentleman entered the office of Smeaton, Weardale, and Smeaton. There was something about him that suggested long residence abroad. His dress and appearance generally, he wore a soft gray felt hat, a large flowing necktie, and loose collar, and a gray check suit of clothes, which, though faultless as to their cut, had never been made in England, or at any rate, not in London. For your London tailor has a style which, to the practiced eye, is unmistakable. The gentleman was evidently an invalid or a convalescent. He was thin, languid, and delicate-looking. There were dark rims under his eyes, and though his face was tanned with sun, it was grayish in its hue, and suggestive of an undermined constitution. Smeaton, Weardale, and Smeaton's office were extensive and luxuriously fitted, as became a first-class firm of estate agents in so fashionable a neighborhood as New Bond Street. The gentleman was received by a page boy and shown into a waiting room, which was furnished with velvet lounges and chairs and plentifully supplied with newspapers. "I wish to see one of the principals," said the gentleman, handing the page boy his card on which was engraved, "Walter Reginald Minton, M.E., British Columbia." The boy bowed, took the card, and retired. In a few minutes, an obsequious clerk entered and with many bows requested Mr. Walter Reginald Minton to kindly step this way, sir. Mr. Minton followed the clerk, who showed him into a large, handsomely furnished room, the walls of which were covered with photographs of houses of all kinds and colored plans of estates. At a massive mahogany desk sat a well-preserved gentleman, long past the prime of life, but with silver hair, a bright, keen eye, and a rubicund face that suggested a fondness for good living in old crusted port. "Do I address Mr. Smeaton?" asked the stranger. "Yes, sir. I am the head of the firm." "Pray take a chair," said Mr. Smeaton, and put his white, fat hands together with professional dignity, and waited for his visitor to state his business. "I've noticed an advertisement in the Times," began Mr. Minton, taking from his pocketbook a half sheet of notepaper, on which the advertisement alluded to had been neatly gummed. "It has reference to the sale of a family residence, and I should like to have some further particulars about it." Mr. Smeaton's eyes brightened up with joyful expectancy as, glancing at the sheet of notepaper, he recognized the advertisement which had become fossilized, so to speak, in the London dailies. "Oh, yes," he answered pleasantly, and with a most becoming smile, "the advertisement accurately describes the property. Where is it situated?" "About 6 miles from the station on the southeastern line, an hour's run from London." "There will be no difficulty in me seeing it?" "No, none whatever. I may mention that I am a mining engineer, and have been for many years in British Columbia, but having made a moderate fortune and being in very bad health, I'm anxious to settle down in my native country." "Ah, just so," remarked Mr. Smeaton blandly, and stroking his smoothly shaven chin. "Are you a family man, Mr. Minton, may I ask?" "Yes, I've a wife and one daughter, 20 years of age." Mr. Smeaton's countenance seemed to fall just ever so little as he replied, "I'm afraid then, if your family is so small, you may find the house larger than you require." "Oh, no," answered Minton quickly, and Mr. Smeaton's countenance recovered again. "We like a large house, for we keep a good deal of company." "Then I don't think you can do better than purchase Dumthorpe Hall," said Mr. Smeaton with a gracious smile. "Is that the name of the place?" "Yes, of course. If you become the owner, you will be at liberty to adopt any other name you like. Now I suggest, before entering into any further particulars, that we go down and see the property. You couldn't have a better day. The country will be charming under this brilliant sun. If you will allow me, I shall have much pleasure in accompanying you." "That will suit me admirably. I'm staying at the Tavistock Hotel. We can call there in a cab and pick up my wife and daughter." Mr. Smeaton struck his bell, and a page boy appeared with such a clarity that one might have thought that the bell set some spring in motion which shot the boy into the room. "Peter, look up the train for Dumthorpe Hall." "Yes, sir." 2 minutes later, the boy came back. "There's a train at 12:50, sir." "Good." Mr. Smeaton looked at his massive gold watch, although a handsome clock stood on the mantelpiece. "The force of habit, no doubt. We have an hour and a half, ample time. And as I have a little business to do, perhaps you will permit me to meet you at the station?" "Oh, certainly." A few minutes later, Mr. Minton was on his way to his hotel, and punctual to the time, he and his wife, a charming but delicate and nervous-looking lady, and his daughter, a no less charming girl, were at the station, where Mr. Smeaton had already arrived and procured first-class tickets. On alighting at the station, after an hour's run through a pleasant country, a brougham and pair of horses which Mr. Smeaton had ordered by telegraph from the landlord of the hotel near the station were waiting, and the party at once drove to Dumthorpe Hall, a distance of over 6 miles from the station. "I should mention," remarked Mr. Smeaton, just before reaching the place, "that the property has unfortunately been allowed to fall into a somewhat dilapidated condition, for the owner, who is in India, has sadly neglected it. However, that will be duly taken into consideration in fixing the purchase money. As regards the situation, the advertisement has scarcely done it justice. The country, diversified with wood, hill, and dale, was charming, and looked at its very best on this brilliant summer's day. The entrance to the grounds of Dumthorpe Hall was through a gateway, the gates being wrought iron and of a handsome design, but now rusty and out of the perpendicular, owing to the sinking of the foundations of one of the pillars on which they were hung. Some difficulty, therefore, was experienced in getting in. There was a small lodge at the entrance, but it was overrun with ragged creepers, and the windows were covered with the accumulated dirt of years. As the visitors stood for a few moments looking about them, after the difficulty of opening the gate had been overcome, Miss Minton suddenly uttered a startled cry and clung in alarm to her father's arm. "What is it? What is it, my dear?" he asked quickly. "Oh, look there," she exclaimed, pointing with her parasol to the ground a few feet away, and he did look and beheld an adder leisurely moving across the pathway. Mr. Smeaton saw it to him. Springing forward, he struck the reptile with his stick, killing it at once, and he tossed it among the trees out of sight. "If I were superstitious," remarked Mr. Minton, "I should take that as an evil omen." "I am glad you are not superstitious, replied Mr. Smeaton with a laugh, "for the fact is, this place has the reputation of being haunted." He uttered this quickly, jerked it out, as it were, as though he was glad to get it off his mind, the incident of the snake having given him the opportunity of making the remark. "Haunted?" exclaimed the two ladies in a breath, while something like a scared appearance came into their faces. "Of course, that won't affect you, lady," said Mr. Smeaton with his bland smile. "You're above being affected by such silly nonsense, I am sure." They walked on, the brougham following slowly. The drive was all overgrown with moss and grass, and strewn with decaying leaves and pieces of branches of trees that had been whirled off by gales. Presently the drive took a turn, then expanded, and the house came in view. It was an old Elizabethan mansion, with pointed gables and a red-tiled roof that gave it a very quaint appearance, but it looked forlorn and mouldering to decay, even with the sun pouring down a flood of golden light upon it. Had it been seen under less favorable atmospheric conditions, it would certainly have worn a repellent aspect. Ivy and honeysuckle had struggled to the very eaves, and hung in straggling and ragged festoons about the windows. The interior of the hall was worse than the exterior. Cobwebs hung from the ceilings in long ropes. The paper had peeled from the walls. The fire grates were red with rust. The windows obscured with dirt. The floors black, and in some places rotten, while pervading the whole house was a dank, earthy, moldering smell, like that which comes from a newly opened tomb. The ladies shuddered and were evidently repelled by the cheerlessness and gloom of the house. But Mr. Smeaton chatted pleasantly and glibly. He had a smooth tongue and great fluency, and knew how to say pretty things in dulcet tones. He was very anxious to get the property off his hands, and as Mr. Minton seemed a likely customer, he was not going to let him slip if talking would secure him. The premises were thoroughly examined. They certainly were commodious and not ill-planned, but paint, paper, and whitewash everywhere wanted renewing. The same neglect characterized the grounds. There were howling wildernesses of ill weeds, and the conservatories were falling to pieces. The ladies certainly were not impressed, although they expressed admiration for the position and view, and there could be no doubt that the situation was healthy, for it stood high. Gravel and chalk were the geological features for miles around, and the air was singularly pure, while the water was liquid crystal. "Well," said Mr. Minton, reflecting when the survey was over, "I can see certain potentialities in that place." "Potentialities?" "I should think so, my dear sir," exclaimed the ancient joyfully. "With the expenditure of a little money, it could be made into a palace." Without answering this remark, Mr. Minton, turning to his wife and daughter, said, "What is your opinion, darlings?" "Well," answered his wife cautiously, "we have seen it under every possible disadvantage as far as neglect and dirt go, and I think it would want a lot of money spending to put it in order." "But what is the story about it being haunted?" asked the young lady, addressing Mr. Smeaton and unable to suppress a little shudder. Mr. Smeaton laughed loudly, almost boisterously, as he made reply, "My dear young lady, such stories as these are always so ridiculous that they cannot be discussed by sensible people." He dismissed the subject with his bland smile and a lofty wave of his white hand. As they returned to town, Mr. Minton, for the first time, asked the price, and the figure named by Mr. Smeaton was so low that the other opened his eyes in astonishment. "Is there anything the matter with the place?" Mr. Minton asked with great point. "Nothing, I pledge you my honor," answered the ancient, equally emphatic. "Beyond its reputation as a haunted house, but it is right to say that that reputation has kept the place untenanted for 20 years, with one short break. It was let on a yearly tenancy to a family who only remained, however, 6 months." "Why did they leave?" asked the two ladies in concert. "They said that they heard noises, and that what looked like blood dripped from the ceilings." "Oh," exclaimed the mother and daughter with a little start, and nestling closer to each other as if for mutual protection. Mr. Minton smiled skeptically, and this smile did not escape the agent, who said quickly, "I have told you frankly the cause of our not being able to let or sell the place. That is the sole reason, and it certainly does not say much for our boasted enlightenment that so splendid a property should go begging through such a senseless cause." "You are right, you are right," exclaimed Mr. Minton,
and the other felt from this that the customer was secured. The following day, Mr. Minton, not wholly with his wife and daughter's approbation, instructed his lawyers to make further inquiries and examine the title deeds. The inquiries elicited nothing beyond what the agent had stated, namely that people said it was haunted, while as for the title deeds, they were beyond dispute or quibble. The price asked was very low, but Mr. Minton's lawyers offered a still lower price, and as the agent's instructions were to sell at any price rather than let the place fall into absolute ruin, the bargain was closed, and Mr. Minton became the absolute possessor of Dumthorpe Hall. He immediately set a little army of workmen to work, gardeners, painters, paper hangers, plumbers, etc., and he was anxious to move in before the winter. Very soon the place had been transformed, and the prejudice of the ladies gave way. As they saw the change, they expressed themselves delighted. As soon as the workmen were out, the upholsterers entered, and as they had carte blanche to furnish the house thoroughly and well, they had soon diffused comfort, warmth, and beauty, where erstwhile all was decay and mildew. It was the last week in October when the family moved in. The autumn tints were on the land, but beyond that, there was no trace of the approaching winter. The days were still warm and bright and sunny, for it had been an exceptionally fine season. A number of servants were already installed. The greenhouses and conservatories were filled with flowers. The gardens were already bright and gay, while in the stables were horses and carriages. In fact, the place was complete with everything that would give comfort or enjoyment to the family. Mr. Minton was a liberal provider, and being wealthy, having made his pile out of mines in British Columbia, he spared no expense. For the first few weeks, all went merry as a marriage bell. The ladies expressed themselves charmed to the place. The dark days of November were drawing to a close, and the house was full of visitors, when one morning the cook approached Mrs. Minton and said, "Can I speak to you, Mum, for a few minutes?" "Certainly, cook. What is it?" "Well, Mum," she began sheepishly, "I have been awfully annoyed for several nights by somebody walking about over my head." "Oh, nonsense, cook. That couldn't be. The room over you is a lumber room, and it's just filled up with boxes." "Yes, Mum, I know that. And that's what makes the noise all the queerer. And then yesterday morning, something came down from the ceiling in the kitchen like blood." Mrs. Minton turned a little pale and shuddered, for she remembered that the agent had mentioned a story about blood dripping from the ceiling. "What an extraordinary thing," she said, with a forced laugh. "But the next time you are troubled with this phenomena, cook, pray come and call me." The cook did not seem quite satisfied as she went away, and that night, about 10 o'clock, she went to her mistress again with a scared white face and said, "It's there again, Mum. Will you please to come to my room?" Mrs. Minton went, and to her surprise, she heard a steady measured tramp, tramp, tramp overhead. She sent for her husband. He came, and he heard the same sounds. He went into the room above, but there was nothing to account for those footsteps. In fact, so full was the room of boxes, trunks, etc., that there was not a clear floor space of 2 yards. Mrs. Minton did not go into the upper room. She waited for her husband coming down, and suddenly, as she was looking up towards the ceiling, something wet fell on her face. She uttered a little startled cry, and taking out her handkerchief, wiped the wet off, and what was her astonishment to find that the handkerchief was stained with blood, or what seemed like blood. Such a shock did this cause her that she almost fainted, and when her husband returned, she was pale and trembling. He expressed himself mystified, and it was evident that he was very much impressed. It was agreed that nothing should be said about this to anyone in the house, and the cook was enjoined to keep the matter secret for the present. But the following morning after breakfast, the gentleman retired to the smoking room for a few whiffs, when a young fellow named Dobble called out as he filled his pipe, "I say, Minton, old fellow, who is lodging over me?" "I don't think anyone is over you. In fact, I'm sure there is not. Why?" "Well, I don't know, but it seemed to me that some fellow with heavy boots did nothing but tramp about all night." Mr. Minton started. He could not help it, and he who had indignantly disavowed any belief in the supernatural was becoming superstitious. He laughed the matter off, however, and told his friend that he must have been suffering from nightmare. For the next 2 or 3 days, nothing else occurred, or at any rate was mentioned, until Miss Minton went into her mother's room in a state of great fright and exclaimed, "Oh, Mama, I've had such a shock. As I was dressing, something fell from the ceiling on my face and neck. and when I wiped it off, it was like blood. Mrs. Minton grew deadly pale as she heard this, but recovering herself quickly, she answered, "Well, darling, I have experienced the same thing, but it is better to say nothing about it. As long as it is not more serious, we must put up with it. When the guests have gone, we will have the house examined. Possibly some trick is being played." Although she thus dismissed the subject, for the time being, she could not get rid of the mystery so easily, and that strange drip from the ceiling was impartial, for it dripped on all alike and in all parts of the house. Other ladies and gentlemen complained of it, and the ladies became alarmed, while a thorough investigation organized by the gentlemen was entirely barren of result. They could discover nothing, absolutely nothing, and the ceilings, which had all been newly whitened, were stainless. These people felt they were in the presence of some mystery which they could not solve. But what was it? Of course, the gentlemen scoffed, and even some of the stronger-minded ladies pooh-poohed. But there were others who held their peace, and as soon as they could courteously do so, they took their departure. Mr. Minton was greatly concerned. If this sort of thing was to continue, he would hardly get guests to stay with him, while, as for his wife and daughter, it was evident they were suffering in their nerves. Then a fresh trouble arose. Some of the servants gave notice to leave, saying they were afraid to stay in such a place. The cook, who was an exceedingly good servant and liked her place, was loath to go, but she said that she would certainly have to leave if the annoyances did not stop. It need scarcely be said that the matter preyed upon Mr. Minton's mind. He had spent a large sum of money upon the house, and to be the victim of such an unsolvable annoyance was a great hardship. As Christmas approached, things seemed to get worse. Those drips from the ceilings were constantly falling, and the tramping, which was confined to two rooms, still went on. It became very obvious to Mr. Minton that his wife and daughter were suffering in health, though they tried not to show it, and he became greatly concerned. A new set of guests came down for Christmas, and care was taken not to put anyone into the rooms below that where the tramping was heard. But people complained, nevertheless, of red moisture dripping on them from the ceilings, and nervous people became frightened. Mr. Minton was not a man to be easily subdued. As a mining engineer, he had faced dangers in all shapes and forms, and had overcome difficulties that would have daunted less determined and less strong-minded men. But now, this constant interruption to his domestic comfort and peace was telling sorely upon his already shattered health. He had come here for quietude and rest, but in spite of his care and lavish expenditure, it seemed as if his hopes were doomed to be blighted, as he was not quite able to divest himself of the idea that he was a victim of some stupid trickery. He, with the aid of a builder, examined the house from roof to basement, and all the time that he was pursuing his investigation, that mysterious dripping of fluid-like blood continued from the ceilings, and the tramping in the lumber room never ceased at nighttime. The examination therefore resulted in nothing, and the mystery was a mystery still. At last, driven to desperation, Mr. Minton resolved to try another expedient. That was to clear out the lumber room, have a bed put up there, and sleep in the room himself. This he did against the earnest, prayerful entreaties of his wife and daughter, and even of the servants, but he was resolute, saying he had never feared living man, and nothing dead could harm him. The arrangements completed, he wished his wife and daughter a fond good night, and when they exacted a promise from him that he would violently ring his bell if he required assistance, he laughed heartily and retired to what had now come to be called in the house the haunted room. His wife and daughter were restless and uneasy, but as the hours sped and there was no sound of the bell, they dropped off to sleep. In the morning, about 9 o'clock, Mr. Minton's valet went up to the room with hot water. He knocked at the door. There was no response. He knocked again, still no answer, so he tried the handle. It yielded, and he entered. Then from his hand fell the hot water jug he was carrying, and he staggered back with a wild cry of alarm. For lying on the bed, his limbs all contorted, the sheets twisted about his body like ropes, as if he had rolled and writhed in some torturing agony, his eyes starting from his head in horror, his mouth wide open, his hands clenched, the nails digging into the palms, was Mr. Minton, stone dead. Medical men were hastily summoned, but their services were of no avail. They could only certify that Mr. Minton, being in very delicate health, had received a shock of some sort which had caused death. A shock of some sort that was only too painfully evident. It did not need a medical man to state that. What they could not state was how the shock had been produced. Poor Mrs. Minton and her daughter were carried prostrated from the fatal house to a neighbor's, and they only entered it once again to take a last look at the remains of the husband and father. When he had been borne to his final resting place, his widow instructed her lawyers to sell off all the furniture immediately. That done, the accursed house was shut up, and it remained shut for over a dozen years. No one could be found to take it, and at least only a few years ago, the estate was sold, the house razed to the ground, and some small villas erected on the land, and Dunthorpe Hall became only a memory. Many people will no doubt remember what a fierce controversy raged at the time of Mr. Minton's tragic death, and now nearly every paper in the kingdom, big and little, advanced some theory to try and account for the phenomena which had alarmed servants and guests alike. Some of the papers discussed the affair banteringly, some with glib platitudes about the pitiable superstition which still lingered in some parts of the country. Others again have seriously, and others still with appallingly lurdness. Divines and laymen alike entered into the conflict of opinions, but in the end nothing was proved. Nothing was solved, and the extraordinary mystery remains a mystery still. Bricket Bottom by Amyas Northcote. The Reverend Arthur Maydew was a hard-working incumbent of a large parish in one of our manufacturing towns. He was also a student and a man of no strong physique, so that when an opportunity was presented to him to take an annual holiday by exchanging parsonages with an elderly clergyman, Mr. Roberts, the squireson of the parish of Overbury, and an acquaintance of his own, he was glad to avail himself of it. Overbury is a small and very remote village in one of our most lovely and rural counties, and Mr. Roberts had long held the living of it. Without further delay, we can transport Mr. Baydew and his family, which consisted only of two daughters, to their temporary home. The two young ladies, Alice and Maggie, the heroines of this narrative, were at that time aged 26 and 24 years respectively. Both of them were attractive girls, fond of such society as they could find in their own parish, and the former especially always pleased to extend the circle of their acquaintance. Although the elder in years, Alice in many ways yielded place to her sister, who was the more energetic and practical, and upon whose shoulders the bulk of the family cares and responsibilities rested. Alice was inclined to be absent-minded and emotional, and to devote more of her thoughts and time to the speculations of an abstract nature than her sister. Both of the girls, however, rejoiced at the prospect of a period of quiet and rest in a pleasant country neighborhood, and both were gratified at knowing that their father would find in Mr. Roberts' library much that would entertain his mind, and in Mr. Roberts' garden an opportunity to indulge freely in his favorite game of croquet. They would have no doubt preferred some cheerful neighbors, but Mr. Roberts was positive in his assurances that there was no one in the neighborhood whose acquaintance would be of interest to them. The first few weeks of their new life passed pleasantly for the Maydew family. Mr. Maydew quickly regained renewed vigor in his quiet and congenial surroundings and in the delightful air, while his daughters spent much of their time in long walks about the country and in exploring its beauties. One evening late in August, the two girls were returning from a long walk along one of their favorite paths, which led along the side of the downs. On their right, as they walked, the ground fell away sharply to a narrow glen named Bricket Bottom, about 3/4 of a mile in length, along the bottom of which ran a little used country road leading to a farm known as Blaze's Farm, and then onward and upward to lose itself as a sheep track on the higher downs. On their right of the slope, some scattered trees and bushes grew, but beyond the lane and running up over the further slope of the glen was a thick wood, which extended away to Carew Court, the seat of a neighboring magnate, Lord Carew. On their left, the open down rose above them, and beyond its crest lay Overbury. The girls were walking hastily, as they were later than they had intended to be, and were anxious to reach home. At a certain point at which they had now arrived, the path forked, the right-hand branch leading down to Bricket Bottom, and the left-hand turning up over the down to Overbury. Just as they were about to turn into the left-hand path, Alice suddenly stopped and pointed downwards, exclaimed, "How very curious, Maggie. Look, there is a house down there in the bottom, which we have, or at least I have never noticed before, often as we have walked up the bottom." Maggie followed with her sister, pointing his finger. "I don't see any house," she said. "Why, Maggie," said her sister, "can't you see it? A quaint-looking, old-fashioned red brick house. There, just where the road bends to the right. It seems to be standing in a nice, well-kept garden, too." Maggie looked again, but the light was beginning to fade in the glen, and she was short-sighted to boot. "I certainly don't see anything," she said. "But then I am so blind, and the light is getting bad. Yes, perhaps I do see a house," she added, straining her eyes. "Well, it is there," replied her sister, "and tomorrow we will come and explore it." Maggie agreed readily enough, and the sisters went home, still speculating on how that happened, not to notice the house before, and resolving firmly on an expedition thither the next day. However, the expedition did not come off as planned, for that evening Maggie slipped on the stairs and fell, spraining her ankle in such a fashion as to preclude walking for some time. Notwithstanding the accident to her sister, Alice remained possessed by the idea of making further investigations into the house she had looked down upon from the hill the evening before, and the next day, having seen Maggie carefully settled for the afternoon, she started off for Bricket Bottom. She returned in triumph and much intrigued over her discoveries, which she eagerly narrated to her sister. "Yes, there was a nice, old-fashioned red brick house, not very large, and set in a charming old-world garden in the bottom. It stood on a tongue of land, jutting out from the woods, just at the point where the lane, after a fairly straight course from its junction with the main road, half a mile away, turned sharply to the right in the direction of Blaze's farm. More than that, Alice had seen the people of the house, whom she described as an old gentleman and a lady, presumably his wife. She had not clearly made out the gentleman, who was sitting in the porch, but the old lady, who had been in the garden busy with her flowers, had looked up and smiled pleasantly at her as she passed. She was sure, she said, that they were nice people and that it would be pleasant to make their acquaintance. Maggie was not quite satisfied with Alice's story. She was of a more prudent and retiring nature than her sister. She had an uneasy feeling that if the old couple had been desirable or attractive neighbors, Mr. Roberts would have mentioned them, and knowing Alice's nature, she said what she could to discourage her vague idea of endeavoring to make acquaintance with the owners of the red brick house. On the following morning, when Alice came to her sister's room to inquire how she did, Maggie noticed that she looked pale and rather absent-minded, and after a few commonplace remarks had passed, she asked, "What is the matter, Alice? You don't look yourself this morning." Her sister gave a slight embarrassed laugh. "Oh, I'm all right," she replied. "Only I did not sleep very well. I kept on dreaming about the house. It was such an odd dream, too. The house seemed to be home and yet to be different." "What? That house in Bricket Bottom?" said Maggie. "Why, what is the matter with you? You seem to be quite crazy about the place." "Well, it is curious, isn't it, Maggie, that we should have only just discovered it and that it looks to be lived in by nice people? I wish we could get to know them." Maggie did not care to resume the argument of the night before, and the subject dropped, nor did Alice again refer to the house or its inhabitants for some little time. In fact, for some days the weather was wet, and Alice was forced to abandon her walks. But when the weather once more became fine, she resumed them, and Maggie suspected that Bricket Bottom formed one of her sister's favorite expeditions. Maggie became anxious over her sister, who seemed to grow daily more absent-minded and silent, but she refused to be drawn into any confidential talk, and Maggie was nonplussed. One day, however, Alice returned from her afternoon walk in an unusually excited state of mind, of which Maggie sought an explanation. It came with a rush. Alice said that afternoon, as she approached the house in Bricket Bottom, the old lady, who as usual was busy in her garden, had walked down to the gate as she passed and had wished her a good day. Alice had replied, and pausing, a short conversation had followed. Alice could not remember the exact tenor of it, but after she had paid a compliment to the old lady's flowers, the latter had rather diffidently asked her to enter the garden for a closer view. Alice had hesitated, and the old lady had said, "Don't be afraid of me, my dear. I like to see young ladies about me, and my husband finds their society quite necessary to him." After a pause, she went on, "Of course, nobody has told you about us. My husband is Colonel Paxton, late of the Indian Army, and we have been here for many, many years. It's rather lonely, for so few people ever see us. Do come in and meet the colonel. I hope you didn't go in, said Maggie rather sharply.
Why not? Replied Alice.
Well, I don't like Mrs. Paxton asking you in that way, answered Maggie.
I don't see what harm there was in the invitation, said Alice. I didn't go in because it was getting late, and I was anxious to get home,
But what? Asked Maggie.
Alice shrugged her shoulders. Well, she said, I've accepted Mrs. Paxton's invitation to pay her a little visit tomorrow,
and she gazed defiantly at Maggie.
Maggie became distinctly uneasy on hearing of this resolution. She did not like the idea of her impulsive sister visiting people on such slight acquaintance, especially as they had never heard them mentioned before. She endeavored by all means, short of appealing to Mr. Maydew, to dissuade her sister from going, at any rate, until there had been some time to make some inquiries as to the Paxtons. Alice, however, was obdurate.
What harm could happen to her? She asked.
Mrs. Paxton was a charming old lady. She was going early in the afternoon for a short visit. She would be back for tea and croquet with her father, and anyway, now that Maggie was laid up, long solitary walks were unendurable, and she was not going to let slip the chance of following up her promise to be a pleasant acquaintance. Maggie could do nothing more. Her ankle was better, and she was able to get down to the garden and sit in a long chair near her father, but walking was still quite out of the question. And it was with some misgiving that on the following day she watched Alice depart gaily for her visit, promising to be back by 4:30 at the very latest. The afternoon passed quietly till nearly 5 when Mr. Maydew, looking up from his book, noticed Maggie's uneasy expression and asked,
"Where's Alice?"
"Out for a walk," replied Maggie, and then after a short pause she went on, "and she has also gone to pay a call on some neighbors whom she recently discovered."
"Neighbors?" ejaculated Mr. Maydew. "What neighbors?"
"Mr. Roberts never spoke of any neighbors to me."
"Well, I don't know much about them," answered Maggie. "Only Alice and I were out walking the day of my accident and saw, or at least she saw, for I am so blind, I could not quite make it out, a house in Bricket Bottom. The next day she went to look at it closer, and yesterday she told me that she made the acquaintance of the people living in it. She says they are a retired Indian officer and his wife, a colonel, and Mrs. Paxton. And Alice describes Mrs. Paxton as a charming old lady who pressed her to come and see them. So she has gone this afternoon, but she promised me she would be back long before this."
Mr. Maydew was silent for a moment and then said, "I'm not well pleased about this. Alice should not be so impulsive and scrape acquaintance with absolutely unknown people. Had there been nice neighbors in Bricket Bottom, I'm sure Mr. Roberts would have told us." The conversation dropped, but both father and daughter were disturbed and uneasy, and tea having been finished and the clock striking 5:30, Mr. Maydew asked Maggie, "When did you say Alice would be back?"
"Before 4:30 at the latest, father."
"Well, what can she be doing? What can have delayed her?
You say you did not see the house," he went on.
"No," said Maggie, "I cannot say I did. It was getting dark, and you know how short-sighted I am."
"But surely you must have seen it at some other time," said her father.
"That is the strangest part of the whole affair," answered Maggie. "We have often walked up the bottom, but I never noticed the house, nor had Alice till that evening. I wonder," she went on after a short pause, "if it would not be so well to ask Smith to harness the pony and drive over to bring her back. I am not happy about her. I am afraid."
"Afraid of what?" said her father in the irritated voice of a man who is growing frightened. "What can have gone wrong in this quiet place? Still, I will send Smith over for her." So saying, he rose from his chair and sought out Smith, the rather dull-witted gardener groom attached to Mr. Roberts' service.
"Smith," he said, "I want you to harness the pony at once and go over to Colonel Paxton's in Bricket Bottom and bring Miss Maydew home." The man stared at him.
"Go where, sir?" he said.
Mr. Maydew repeated the order, and the man, still staring stupidly, answered, "I never heard of Colonel Paxton, sir. I don't know what house you mean."
Mr. Maydew was now growing really anxious.
"Well, harness the pony at once," he said, and going back to Maggie, he told her of what he called Smith's stupidity, and asked her if she felt that her ankle would be strong enough to permit her to go with him and Smith to the bottom to point out the house. Maggie agreed readily, and in a few minutes the party started off. Bricket Bottom, although not more than 3/4 miles away,
over the downs was at least 3 miles by road, and it was nearly 6 o'clock before Mr. Maydew left time for Vicarage, and the pony was old and slow. It was getting late before the entrance to Bricket Bottom was reached. Turning into the lane, the cart proceeded slowly up the bottom. Mr. Maydew and Maggie looked anxiously from side to side, while Smith drove solidly on, looking neither to the right nor left. "Where is the house?" said Mr. Maydew presently. "At the bend of the road," answered Maggie, her heart sickening as she looked out through the failing light to see the trees stretching their ranks in unbroken formation along it. The cart reached the bend. "It should be here," whispered Maggie. They pulled up. Just in front of them, the road bent to the right, round a tongue of land, which, unlike the rest of the right-hand side of the road, was free from trees and was covered only by rough grass and stray bushes. A closer inspection disclosed evident signs of terraces having once been formed on it, but of a house there was no trace. "Is this the place?" said Mr. Maydew in a low voice. Maggie nodded. "But there is no house here," said her father. "What does it all mean? Are you sure of yourself, Maggie? Where is Alice?" Before Maggie could answer, a voice was heard calling, "Father, Maggie!" The sound of the voice was thin and high, and paradoxically it sounded both very near and yet as if it came from some infinite distance. The cry was thrice repeated, and silence fell. Mr. Maydew and Maggie stared at each other. "That was Alice's voice," said Mr. Maydew huskily. "She is near, and in trouble, and is calling us. Which way do you think it came from, Smith?" he added, turning to the gardener.
"I didn't hear anybody calling," said the man.
"Nonsense," answered Mr. Maydew. And then he and Maggie both began to call, "Alice, Alice, where are you?" There was no reply. Mr. Maydew sprang from the cart, at the same time bidding Smith to hand the reins to Maggie and come and search for the missing girl. Smith obeyed him, and both men, scrambling up the turfy bit of ground, began to search and call through the neighboring wood. They heard and saw nothing, however, and after an agonized search, Mr. Maydew ran down to the cart and begged Maggie to drive on to Blaze's farm for help, leaving himself and Smith to continue the search. Maggie followed her father's instructions and was fortunate enough to find Mr. Rumbold, the farmer, his two sons, and a couple of laborers just returning from the harvest field. She explained what had happened, and the farmer and his men promptly volunteered to form a search party, though Maggie, in spite of her anxiety, noticed a queer expression on Mr. Rumbold's face as she told him her tale. The party, provided with lanterns, now went down to the bottom, joined Mr. Maydew and Smith, and made an exhaustive but absolutely fruitless search of the woods near the bend of the road. No trace of the missing girl was to be found, and after a long and anxious time, the search was abandoned, one of the young Rumbolds volunteering to ride into the nearest town and notify the police. Maggie, though with little hope in her own heart, endeavored to cheer her father on their homeward way with the idea that Alice might have returned to Overbury over the downs while they were going by road to the bottom, that she had seen them and called to them in jest when they were opposite the tongue of land. However, when they reached home, there was no Alice. And though the next day the search was resumed and full inquiries were instituted by the police, all was to no purpose. No trace of Alice was ever found, the last human being that saw her having been an old woman who had met her going down the path into the bottom on the afternoon of her disappearance, and who described her as smiling but looking queer-like. This is the end of the story, but the following may throw some light upon it. The history of Alice's mysterious disappearance became widely known through the medium of the press. Mr. Roberts, distressed beyond measure at what had taken place, returned in all haste to Overbury to offer what comfort and help he could give to his afflicted friend and tenant. He called upon the Maydews, and having heard their tale, sat for a short time in silence, and he said, "Have you ever heard any local gossip concerning this Colonel and Mrs. Paxton?"
"No," replied Mr. Maydew. "I never heard their names until the day of my poor daughter's fatal visit."
"Well," said Mr. Robert, "I will tell you all I can about them, which is not very much, I fear." He paused and then went on. "I am now nearly 75 years old, and for nearly 70 years no house has stood in Bricket Bottom. But when I was a child of about 5 years old, there was an old-fashioned red brick house standing in a garden at the bend of the road, such as you have described. It was owned and lived in by a retired Indian soldier and his wife, a colonel, and Mrs. Paxton. At the time I speak of, certain events having taken place at the house, and the old couple having died, it was sold by their heirs to Lord Carew, who shortly after pulled it down to the ground that interfered with his shooting. Colonel and Mrs. Paxton were well known to my father, who was the clergyman here before me, and to the neighborhood in general. They lived quietly and were not unpopular, but the colonel was supposed to possess a violent and vindictive temper. Their family consisted only of themselves, their daughter, and a couple of servants, the colonel's old army servant and his Eurasian wife. Well, I cannot tell you the details of what happened. I was only a child. My father never liked gossip, and in later years, when he talked to me on the subject, he always avoided any appearance of exaggeration or sensationalism. However, it is known that Miss Paxton fell in love with and became engaged to a young man to whom her parents took a strong dislike. They used every possible means to break off the match, and many rumors were set on foot as to their conduct. Undue influence, even cruelty, were charged against them. I do not know the truth. All I can say is that Miss Paxton died, and a very bitter feeling against her parents sprang up. My father, however, continued to call, but was rarely admitted. In fact, he never saw Colonel Paxton after his daughter's death, and only Mrs. Paxton once or twice. He described her as an utterly broken woman, and was not surprised at her following her daughter to the grave in about 3 months' time. Colonel Paxton became, if possible, more recluse than ever after his wife's death, and himself died not more than a month after her, under circumstances which pointed to suicide. Again, a crop of rumors sprang up, but there was no one in particular to take action. The doctor certified death from natural causes, and Colonel Paxton, like his wife and daughter, was buried in this churchyard. The property passed to a distant relative who came down to it for one night shortly afterwards. He never came again, having apparently conceived a violent dislike to the place, but arranged to pension off the servants and then sold the house to Lord Carew, who was glad to purchase this little island in the middle of his property. He pulled it down soon after he had bought it, and the garden was left to relapse into a wilderness. Mr. Roberts paused. "Those are all the facts," he added. "But there is something more," said Maggie. Mr. Roberts hesitated for a while. "You have a right to know all," he said, almost to himself. Then louder he continued, "What I am now going to tell you is really rumor, vague and uncertain. I cannot fathom its truth or its meaning. About 5 years after the house had been pulled down, a young maidservant at Carew Court was out walking one afternoon. She was a stranger to the village and a newcomer to the court. On returning home to tea, she told her fellow servants that as she walked down Bricket Bottom, which place she described clearly, she passed a red brick house at the bend of the road, and that a kind-faced old lady had asked her to step in for a while. She did not go in, not because she had any suspicions of there being anything uncanny, but simply because she feared to be late for tea. I do not think she ever visited the bottom again, and she had no other similar experience, so far as I am aware. 2 or 3 years later, shortly after my father's death, a traveling tinker with his wife and daughter camped for the night at the foot of the bottom. The girl strolled away up the glen to gather blackberries and was never seen or heard of again. She was searched for in vain. Of course, no one knows the truth. And she may have run away voluntarily from her parents, although there was no cause for her doing so. That, concluded Mr. Roberts, is all I can tell you. I've either facts or rumors. All that I can now do is to pray for you and for her.